now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult the propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The Apostle Paul told us that our battle was not against flesh and blood opponents, but against powers, principalities, rulers of spiritual darkness. But our popular culture lately has been, well, fantasizing about and fixating on creatures that in a prior generation were considered monsters, but now are sort of anti-heroes, and they primarily feast on flesh and blood. That is, human flesh and blood. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. As we approached Halloween, it seemed only right and fitting to continue with what's become sort of a tradition here in the bunker, to welcome back a guest who has made a study of monsters, as it were, and specifically how they relate to a Christian worldview. He's author of Interview with the Giant, Ethno-Historical Notes on the Nephilim, a reconstruction of the history of the lost race of giants called the Nephilim. He's an archaeologist, an historian, and a founding member of the West Texas Paranormal Research Society. His website is burtonbeyond.com. We refer to him as our friendly neighborhood PhD, Dr. Judd Burton. Judd, it's good to talk with you again.
Good to talk with you, Derek.
Before we really get into the discussion tonight, I understand that there is a mentor, someone that you would like to pay tribute to before we really get into the meat of the discussion tonight.
Yes, I'd like to dedicate the show to who's a good friend of mine and mentor when I was in graduate school, Harley Gallen, who passed away this week. And he was a singular individual. He was the first person that gave me a job as a historian. He just really lived life on his own terms. He was an officer in the Navy in World War II, done well on his own, and founded this Heritage Foundation and needed a historian, and I was available, and he helped give me my first gig as a primary investigator on an archaeological excavation, and in many ways kind of set me on the course that I'm on. And so I'm very grateful to have worked under and with this very godly man, and would just like to dedicate this to he and his family, Harley Gallen.
Hmm. Well spoken. The Halloween season, it has become in American culture the second most popular holiday after the Christmas season. We here in Central Illinois, maybe you see this down where you are in Texas, Judd, see occasionally people who are now putting lights in the bushes and trees outside at Halloween, just as they do at Christmas, except usually orange and black. Pumpkins with faces everywhere, and of course, as Halloween night approaches, and it's not just for kids anymore. Kids dress up, of course, but we see a lot of adults take advantage of the holiday as an opportunity to dress in escapist costumes and engage in behavior that perhaps they wouldn't on any other night, except perhaps New Year's Eve. Before we dig in specifically to the monsters du jour. What is it about this holiday that has transformed it from a night of dread to a night of revelry?
Well, the history of Halloween in this country, as you and I have discussed on a number of occasions, goes back to the colonial era, when it was primarily the Anglicans brought over the holiday and would celebrate it. As far as the Puritans were concerned, this was very taboo. You weren't going to be dressing up like any animal spirits. But for the Anglicans who settled primarily in the southern colonies, it was a very popular, lighthearted sort of a time. And these traditions continued as more, particularly Irish immigrants, began to come to the colonies. And eventually, after we became a nation, the flood continued, particularly in the 1840s, because of the potato famine. But Halloween, as it began to evolve in this country, developed into a kind of excuse to be mischievous. And it went through a period of on one level, it was a sort of innocent kids' holiday, but on another level, it was an excuse to espouse all kinds of violence, from vandalism to even murder. You can look at period newspapers from the Gilded Age and the early 1900s, and the record attests that was the case in a lot of the big cities, especially. But this spirit of mayhem seems to be something that was always probably just below the surface, just because of the abandon that's often associated with a holiday. And of course, that goes much farther back than the colonial era. We're talking about the European, in particular the Celtic roots of the celebration itself. But on a popular level, in the last 50 or 60 years, it's as popular as any of the holidays we celebrate at the end of the year, the three biggies, Halloween, Thanksgiving, and Christmas, complete with its own set of decorations that if anybody were to put out at any other time of the year, their neighbors would probably be calling the police to haul them off. So there's a prescribed and popularly accepted way in this country to celebrate or observe the holiday for those who are inclined to do so. There are also some other disturbing images that are associated with Halloween as well, which we will, if you'll pardon the early pun, flesh out during the course of the interview today.
Yeah. We have talked before about vampires and the fascination with vampires. We'll get to that in just a bit, but over the last couple of years, we've seen a real surge in the popularity of entertainment focusing on zombies, movies, graphic novels, video games, a television series. One of the most popular television series on cable right now is Walking Dead on AMC. What is the history of the zombie? Where did the word originate? How long has the concept of the undead feasting on the flesh of the living been around?
Well, the actual word that we use, zombie, is a Haitian Creole word. In fact, a lot of our popular conceptions and beliefs about the zombie come from Haitian Vodun, or as it's more commonly known, Voodoo. But there were any number of these Afro-Caribbean religions that developed amongst slave populations in the Caribbean islands once you began to see more Central and West African individuals transported to be sold off as slaves. There are a number of religious traditions, inclusive of Voodoo, but also in Latin America, you have Santeria, and in South America, particularly Brazil, Candomblé is the predominant African-based religion. But they're all very similar, and they all share this concept of the zombie, which is an animated, or as the case would be, a sort of revenant or reanimated corpse procured by some means of witchcraft. There is an extensive history, and we actually have pretty good anthropological records about the zombie tradition in the Caribbean, and by proxy, West Africa, from the peoples that they descended from. If you look at the zombie as a concept and look at it ethnologically, you could spin the globe and stop it anywhere, and you're likely to find within the folklore or mythology of a given culture, you're likely to find a creature that is very similar to the zombie, or what the what we talk about today as a zombie. But the entry point there for Western familiarization with the concept begins with the Afro-Caribbean slave traditions of the zombie, particularly from Haiti. But in many ways, the Haitian zombie is, at least folklorically, is very similar to the Eastern European revenant, what was popularly called the Nosferatu, the undead, which many vampire aficionados will recognize as a touchstone word for vampire.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some similarity, not only in terms of the folkloric origins of both of these creatures, but also in terms of their appetite for flesh, and more specifically, especially in the case of European revenants, blood. But again, this archetype, if you will, is something that's perennial. You're likely to find these creatures in various forms all around the globe and in various traditions. As far as the earliest kinds of zombie-like creatures that we have recorded in Western tradition, you really don't need to look much further than the Fertile Crescent, because a zombie sort of creatures are mentioned in the Gilgamesh epic, which was originally a Sumerian story about a king of the city-state of Uruk. But there are at least two passages in the Gilgamesh epic that sort of allude to this. One is, I'll raise up the dead and they will devour the living. I will make the dead outnumber the living.
Huh.
Let's see. I think I've got another one marked here. I was taken to the house whose inhabitants are deprived of light and place, but dust is their sustenance, their food clay, their clothes like a bird with feathered raiment. So even in this epic, which is ostensibly much older than when it was written down, so we're probably talking 5,000 plus years, you have reference to these zombie-like creatures, if you will.
Huh. Now, I've not read the epic itself, but I read about the Gilgamesh epic, but that's not usually one of the points that's brought out by commentators.
No, usually, and rightfully so. I mean, Gilgamesh, I'm convinced, is we're dealing with the same character as Nimrod. There usually Gilgamesh, and any discussion surrounding him has to do with his semi-divine character and the fact that he has one divine parent and one human parent, and that's very similar to what we find with the origin of the Nephilim, again, as most researchers will recognize, and right, a lot of your listeners will too. But yeah, usually when you think Gilgamesh, you typically don't think, hey, zombies, but
no,
here they are.
Huh. So that's something that's been around for a while, at least in the concept. What is it, and you know, I understand that the popularity of the character or the archetype really took off after George Romero's was Night of the Living Dead, 1968. So the zombie, as we really understand it, he really did. What kind of impact did Night of the Living Dead have on the public perception of zombies?
I would say a very shaping one. Romero's work, it has to be remembered, is actually based on a novel by Richard Matheson called I Am Legend, which was recently adapted into, has been adapted a number of times. Romero admitted that he used that as a basis for his story. And if listeners are familiar with the story, it's extremely similar. if you look at the various adaptations of I'm Legend, like the classic Vincent Price, The Last Man on Earth, I think is what it was called.
And what was it? Who was it? Omega Man, wasn't that?
I think Omega Man. Yeah, Omega Man was another one. That's right. There have been a number of them. The most recent one was the I'm Legend with Will Smith in the key role, and that one sort of veers away from the vampire story and sort of is almost Romero-esque, and the creatures in it are more zombie-like per se than vampire.
Mm-hmm.
On a popular level, Romero's work is, I mean, it's a cult classic, so it had a tremendous role in shaping the popular image of the zombie. But I would also say that movies like White Zombie with Bela Lugosi would have been another one that shaped the popular image. And kind of an interesting time when that movie was, I think that movie came out in the late 30s, right after the United States had occupied Haiti. And there had actually been a number of scholars who had done some work on the culture of voodoo in Haiti. And one of the works, I think, was called The Magic Island, was about the zombie tradition in particular. And so that movie, The White Zombie, had the benefit of all of that new information.
Hmm.
So it's kind of an interesting time for zombies, I suppose. It's a popular concept.
Interesting, too, that Lugosi was involved in two films that really shaped the understanding of some of the classic horror archetypes, of course, playing the title role in Dracula, which was produced at about that time.
Yes. And everyone since, even if they were trying to put their own stamp on the character, gave some sort of homage to Lugosi's interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, Lugosi also had a role in, wasn't the original Frankenstein, but the follow-up Bride of Frankenstein. So at least he was a part of that one as well. Another one of the archetypes, Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, that's a whole other show right there.
Exactly.
In a box.
So the level of violence depicted in Night of the Living Dead, though, by George Romero, was shocking for the time.
Certainly.
With, you know, shots of zombies feasting on the entrails of their human victims, really way over the top compared to other films of that era. Fairly tame by modern standards. When you're dealing with a monster that is so, I mean, there's something visceral and repulsive about the idea of being consumed by another being, and especially by what might be the animated corpse of your dead grandmother or something. There's something at a gut level that just is really repugnant and repulsive about that type of creature. I frankly don't like zombie movies because they set me on edge for some reason. And maybe it's that aspect of it. But there are people who are hooked on them. And I know some people who are some Christian brothers who admit to a secret addiction to zombie entertainment. What is it about, and obviously there's a market for it, otherwise we wouldn't see such movies as World War Z, Zombieland, Sci-Fi as a series out there called Z Nation, and of course we mentioned Walking Dead. What is it about this particular type of monster that lends itself to becoming a popular form of mass entertainment or the feature of mass entertainment?
Well, it's not sexy like the European vampire. You know, it's not the...
No, it's repugnant.
The seduction element is turned on its head in many ways. There's something about, I think, the revenant in general, whether we're talking about, particularly if we're talking about a zombie, or that there's a collective will. There's no individuality. There's no personality per se. And because they seem to be bereft of a soul, there seems to be, there's this perception of no accountability. That there's no morality or ethos to be followed. And that, I think, is in some ways appealing on a popular level. I mean, you know, just imagine if you could do with abandon whatever you wanted to without any accountability. The zombie is kind of a personification of that, at least the popular American interpretation of the zombie. But if you look at the zombie, again, conceptually, if you look at it through the lens of ethnology, then the zombie was a tool of malice for the most part, because it was reanimated by, or created, or whatever the machination to make the zombie creature, whatever culture you're talking about, because it's usually a different prescription for every culture. However they're made, they're usually made for ill intent. So you also have to kind of consider that when looking at the appeal of the zombie is a popular literary or film creature. But in reality, you know, I'll state as I have before, what you're looking at is a demonic force. You're not looking at, that's why I say you have to defang the vampire. You have to take his cape away. You have to take away the popular image mm-hmm. of these quote-unquote monsters before you can get down to what they are in reality. And it's hard to do that because we are lambasted with the image, the series, the movies. I mean, you can't escape the images, particularly, you know, around this time of the year. But if you look, again, if you look at the zombie as a concept, they're usually tools of a witch or a sorcerer carry out some sort of malicious intent.
The creation of the zombie has changed. I mean, the white zombie concept or conception of the character in the Lugosi film was, you know, he could use his eyes and his special zombie grip, his little hand thing that he did. Which shows up, now I understand why he did that in the Martin Landau character when he played Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood was doing that thing with his hands. He was trying to make people bend people to his will, to do his bidding. In more recent incarnations of the zombie, films and so forth, it's often a virus that causes the disease. And if you get bitten, then you become one of the undead. So how does that affect the moral culpability of the zombie in the more modern interpretations?
Well, again, if you're infected with a pathogen that does something like that, exactly. I mean, what moral culpability is there? It's sort of stripped away, because even the movies that are based strictly, you know, on a quote unquote sort of scientific approach to the zombie, turn them into basically the same kind of mindless revenants. So the end result, that is the zombie, the creation of the zombie, seems to be the same, whether you're looking at it through the literary lens, or you're looking at it through the more anthropological.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually, like I said, there's actually a hefty corpus of anthropological data on the creation of zombies in the Caribbean realm. Listeners may remember the movie The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was actually based on a book of the same name by an ethnobotanist from Harvard by the name of Wade Davis. Davis did a lot of work on what he thought was one, at least one of the ways that, these revenants were created, the so-called zombie powder, which was which contained large amounts of tetrodotoxin from the pufferfish. And that's how, supposedly, a number of zombies had been created during the course of the presence of, these religions like Voodoo and Katamble and Santeria in the New World. But as for a pathogen, that's really on the more conjecture side, the more literary side at this point.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
most of the shows that you see now, most of the programs that you see are based on that that proposition that there was a pathogen that turned people into zombies.
And I guess
it's an interesting proposition. Well, I'm not saying that there isn't some pathogen out there that couldn't do that, because we're finding new organisms every day.
Well, yeah, and actually there are some that scientists have discovered recently that, there was the presence of some, and I don't know if it was a parasite or... yeah, maybe a parasite, I think, that when it's present in the system of mice, makes them more reckless. So they're more likely to, you know, try to outrun the cat, for example, and get eaten, which then propagates the life cycle of the parasite, because then it goes into the cat, is excreted, and then winds up, you know, being cycled back around through. I mean, it's, you know, insanely crazy when is that how this thing propagates? But it makes you wonder if there are similar substances or organisms out there that similarly make humans participate in more reckless behavior. But the reason I put that question out there, I mean, the zombie, you know, again, is a creature that's operating under, you know, almost by remote control. It cannot help itself. It has one directive, which is to feed on, you know, human flesh. But in the earlier incarnations, you know, the Gilgamesh epic, even, you know, through, say, Bela Lugosi in 1932, was being directed by an intelligence of evil, with evil intent.
That's right.
So at least you could say, okay, these things are mindless, so they can't be blamed, but they're being directed by something evil. Whereas in the more modern films, you get bitten by a zombie, you become a zombie because of, you know, presumably some pathogen, and so you can't help yourself. And so, you know, it takes anyway. So that there's some intelligent, evil intelligence behind the whole thing, out of the picture. And I just wonder if there was some purpose for that. And maybe that makes it a little easier for people to, you know, watch zombie films and enjoy them.
Right. When you strip the ultimate good and the ultimate evil out of the question, then it just becomes raw entertainment.
Yeah.
There's no philosophical proposition to consider, other than cold, hard evolution, basically.
Yeah, survival of the fittest.
Exactly.
Them what's fastest who can get to the mall first and lock themselves in.
That's exactly right. Both for the zombies and for the people who are fending them off.
Mm-hmm.
This pathogen is trying to protect itself, as are the people. But moving closer to the biblical lens, a lot of the behavior of the zombie is reminiscent of the behavior that we find amongst the first generation of giants in the antediluvian world. We can go to Enoch and look at how this war that they ended up fighting against each other was only after they had consumed the resources of humanity. And they began to feed on humans and drink their blood, and then they turned on each other and began to do the same thing. So this element of cannibalism also seems to be an ensconcement in the concept of a zombie. And it, just in terms of spiritual roots, I think you could take that puppy all the way back to the Book of Enoch in particular.
Hmm. God had some pretty specific things about the shedding of human blood, and I suspect that that would also apply to consuming human flesh, because you can't do one without the other.
That's correct.
Yeah, it was, just a small hint. God was totally against it.
It was part of the abominable, wicked things that that were happening on the earth at the time.
Yeah.
Listeners and students of the Bible alike are all familiar with the tradition of the flood and why it came upon the earth. And this, however small a factor, has to be part of the equation.
Well, yeah, you know, that's it.
If you want to call it factor Z, if you want to make an equation out of it, this is literally the Z component.
And that's really interesting, because Sharon and I have been producing a virtual house fellowship on Sunday mornings the last 4 weeks, and we're slowly working our way through the Book of Genesis right now, and we had just gotten past the flood story, and that was one of the first things that God communicated to Noah after the flood. You shall not shed the blood of a human, for every and whenever human blood is shed, I will require a reckoning, even if a beast should shed the blood of a human, from them I will require a reckoning. Like, okay, so there's something about the shedding of blood that is not to be done. And the further you go into the Bible, the more you realize that this is a theme that runs all the way through the Old Testament, all the way into the New Testament.
Sure.
And again, while the consumption of human flesh isn't specifically prohibited in the Bible, when you look at some of the extra biblical sources like Enoch and see what the Nephilim were doing, maybe that is one of the reasons that God said, don't shed human blood, period, end of story. Mm-hmm. And perhaps why so many of the pagan religions required the shedding of human blood.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. Again, because the root of those traditions are demonic. I mean, all one has to do is to look at the pantheons. Some of these, well, in this case, what would have been West Asian polytheistic traditions, these things are reprehensible. I mean, they demanded. Think of Molech.
Mm-hmm.
Molech demanded a hefty dose of blood, and not just any blood, but the blood of children.
Mm-hmm.
The people that worship Molech offered their children up into these flaming bronze statues that were essentially furnaces, and the statues had these outstretched arms, and the people would place the children in the arms, and the infants would tumble into the furnace.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take a philosopher to look at that and say that that's morally reprehensible.
Yeah.
And that's just one example. I mean, there's some really, really nasty, ugly characters in some of these pantheons. You take a lot of this stuff back to the antediluvian world. You can take it, you and I talked about the vampiric roots the gigantic antediluvian roots of vampirism in the New World. I devoted an entire chapter in my book to that particular topic. But also witchcraft, the sort of bending of nature for a selfish end. That all goes back to this sort of tutelage that the Watchers were giving to humanity in exchange for sexual access to females in the antediluvian world. And I would argue that even the basis for the zombie as a concept can be taken all the way back to what happens before the flood.
Hmm.
But these this ultimate legislation that's being handed down by God almost as soon as the water is dry. You know, this stuff is Noahide. It predates, as you said, you know, it's directly after the flood. It predates all the Levitical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows for how many, depending on what chronology somebody, you know, subscribes to, who knows for how long this stuff was oral tradition. It could have been millennia that it was oral tradition, that it was part of the people who would become known as the Hebrews, that they were not to shed blood in not just one way, but in a number of prescribed ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a word search with any electronic Bible or at blueletterbible.org will make it very clear. You just do a word search for blood, and it will surprise you how often it's the word shows up in the Bible and how often it shows up in the context of God giving very specific instructions as to when it should be shed, and typically, you know, sacrificial animals, and then what's to be done with it once it's been shed, and what type of blood is not supposed to be shed or consumed, and specifically the prescriptions are, against shedding of human blood are repeated many times. And I'm trying to find the verses here. It begins in Genesis chapter 9. Where God tells Noah, you know, first of all, you're not supposed to eat any flesh with the blood in it, the flesh of any animal. But for your lifeblood, God tells Noah, I will require a reckoning. From every beast I will require it, and from man, from his fellow man, I will require a reckoning for the life of man. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image.
And who is it that pays the ultimate reckoning?
Exactly.
It's the Messiah. And what does he do? He tells his disciples, "You will eat my blood. You go eat my flesh and drink my blood." Right,
right. Which was a bit disconcerting for those who heard that message the first time.
Sure, but you know what he's talking about is he's telling them, like, "Look, I've answered the ultimate reckoning. To take part in that, you know, here is." One thing you do in remembrance of me. And that's where we get the sacraments for. But just as I mentioned that because just as the vampire is as you and I have discussed before, just as the vampire is a polar opposite of what Jesus offers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the antithesis, it's the corruption, it's the turning on its head of everything that he offers. It's a false sacrament that the vampire offers. In many ways, the zombie is the same way, because what is he doing? He's eating the flesh and he's drinking the blood, but against the prescription of the message of the Messiah.
Mm-hmm. One of the more popular anime series that's made the jump from Japan to the United States here in the last couple of years is one called Attack on Titan. And that was recommended to me by Gans Shimura and Taylor Kent, and it features a remnant of humanity that is trying to defend itself against a race of giants that appeared mysteriously, who periodically, for whatever reason, just start smashing down human habitations, taking the people and eating them.
Mm-hmm.
The giants come in a variety of shapes and sizes, and they appear to be able to subsist without eating humans. They just do it apparently because they like to. And I've been watching the series. I'm not that far into it yet, and humanity hasn't turned the tide against these titans yet. But I think it's interesting that you've got a series which is not presenting this from a Christian perspective, but does it seems to be, you know, referencing at least a couple of the images or archetypes that we've been talking about tonight, the zombie, the eating of human flesh anyway, what appear to be mindless creatures that don't communicate. They just, you know, they just want to eat people. That's all that they apparently do. Then, of course, the fact that they're giants and referred to in the title as titans, which is, of course, a Greek mythological creature, which may be another callback to the Nephilim.
certainly. Well, at the very least, that series sounds quite disturbing.
Yeah.
if you were to tell me the plot of that without the title or where it was produced or whatever, I would have said that the producers of that series were getting their material from the Bible.
Very possibly.
At the very least, they were taking it from at least some of their cues from the Book of Enoch.
Yeah, kind of in the same way that the Matrix films, you know, borrowed from the Bible, certain concepts and certain names, but then of course the message wasn't anywhere close to accurate. But or maybe more accurately, the more recent Noah movie starring Russell Crowe.
Which we will never mention again.
That's
right.
That's it. well, we've talked about the shedding of blood, and so we should transition into the discussion of the vampire, mm-hmm. because the vampire is certainly another one of these monster archetypes, along with the werewolf, that has sort of been rehabilitated. And I guess in contrast to the zombie, which is still considered a villain, or at least a creature of evil, one that can, you know, do harm. The vampire has been turned into a heroic character, a sexy character, in recent years. That might have even begun with the Bela Lugosi film, because I know women thought, you know, his eyes were. I mean, there was an element of sex appeal to the character as portrayed by Lugosi on the film, in contrast to Nosferatu, which was a generation earlier, and he was a hideous, sure. You know, sharp-fanged, taloned creature that was not appealing in any way.
Well, yeah, he had more in common with the folkloric vampire.
Right.
The literary.
And by contrast, you know, Count Dracula was a charming, sophisticated, could mingle with society to an extent, and it had that element of White Zombie, I guess, about, you know, with the eyes, where he could, you know, hypnotize women into doing what he wanted. But, you know, we get into the modern films, and well, you know, talked about popular cable television series. True Blood is one of the more popular cable series of recent years. It had a 5-year run, something like that, and a number of other popular forms of entertainment. Now, one of the more interesting that we mentioned before we started recording tonight, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which was a great novel. Maybe the movie wasn't quite up to the novel, but at least in Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, the vampires were still portrayed as bad guys.
That's correct. And our pop culture, in this country in particular, but also in the West, is sort of crossed that traditional boundary, even with all the teasing of Victorian taboo that Stoker did with his novel. You still knew that Dracula was the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
But 100 years of literary criticism to the side, at the end of the day, he still knew that this guy was the bad guy, and he was going to get his from the good guys. You have that formula in books and movies like Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, but slightly more popular, again, as you say, is not the vilification of the vampire, but the creation of the vampire hero or the vampire anti-hero, at the least.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, with the golden age of cinema, you sort of see that. But again, even with the Lugosi movies, as alluring as he was supposed to be, with later incarnations like Christopher Lee, his portrayals, you pretty much knew that he was a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
got the villain down to an art. Really, in film, I don't think you really start to see that tide beginning to turn until the adaptation with Franklin Gela and Laurence Olivier. You know, Franklin Gela said he didn't want to play Dracula the way he'd been played, and so he plays him almost like a male lead in a soap opera or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in literature, I think the last kind of the exclamation point on the vampire, whether he was a villain or a hero, sort was Anne Rice. Anne Rice was an excellent writer, but even with the characters that she wrote, they were anti-heroes at best, because there was always this element of, yes, they were powerful, and yes, they had all this mystique about them, but there was this self-loathing inherent in all of her characters, and the self-loathing I always thought was interesting came from the fact that they were no longer human.
Mm-hmm.
That they were immortal, but immortality in some way damned them to being perpetually lonely, because they never aged. They saw their friends grow old and die, and people that they fell in love with grow old and die, and this, that, and the other. And the becoming a vampire in the Rice novels robbed these characters of their humanity, and that was the grim realization that they all came to. But now you've got a whole new generation of writers like Stephanie Meyer,
mm-hmm.
Just completely turning this archetype on its head, and it's popular for many of the reasons that you and I have discussed heretofore, that vampires are immortal, and they offer this mystique that isn't readily available. But again, if you defang the vampire, if you take away the dross of the vampire, all of the literary dross that has been piled upon the vampire as a literary character, take away the European nobleman, take away the alluring seducer, take away a lot of that stuff, and what you're left with is a demonic entity, which breaks all of the prescriptions against blood taking that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And again, by way of review, it also turns the Messiah, or the role of the Messiah, on his head, and makes a complete mockery. What is offered through the Messiah.
Yeah, as we've said before, and I wish I had thought of this, but it's not original to me, the Messiah, Jesus Christ, shed his blood so that his followers would have eternal life. The vampire sheds the blood of his victims so that he can have eternal life.
That's it.
And even then, though, the life of the vampire is a cheap copy of the eternal life that the followers of Jesus Christ receive. I mean, the vampire's living only in the dark and sleeping, you know, in the earth during the day, whereas we're told that those who follow Jesus Christ will eventually wind up living in the New Jerusalem, where there will be no need for the sun, because God himself will be the light, and there will be light, you know, eternally. I mean, it's just such a complete opposite of the picture that we get from Jesus Christ.
Certainly, in many ways, it's much like what the Nakash, the serpent, offers Adam and Eve in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he's promising them tweaked versions of what they already had. Well, you'll be like God. You'll live forever. Well, they're already living forever. You'll be like a god. Well, if they wanted to have knowledge, all they had to do was ask God. He was right there. He wasn't offering them really anything that they didn't have already, and in abundance, but offered this counterfeit version of it. And in that way, some literary and film vampires, and certainly folkloric vampires, propose the same sorts of things.
As we approach Halloween, we're bound to see a lot of costumed zombies and vampires. People, children mainly, but also some adults who will dress up in these roles. We wouldn't see people dressing, and I don't mean to be, you know, gross or offensive here, but we wouldn't see people dressing as, say, a pedophile for a Halloween party, or a mass murderer. I mean, one that we can historically identify. You wouldn't see somebody going to a party dressed as, say, Richard Speck or Jeffrey Dahmer or somebody like that, John Wayne Gacy. But yet, people are willing to go as the fictional representation of something that feasts on human flesh or drinks human blood. Why?
Why indeed? You know, again, as I've said before, I can't tell people to, one way or the other, to do that or not to do that, but only to take into account, the concepts of the vampire, of the zombie, of the werewolf or whatever, and just step back and look at it through the biblical lens for a minute. And you'll see it for what it is. And then you might be less inclined to don those sorts of accoutrements.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people who aren't Christian, people who are not, who do not necessarily accept Judeo-Christian morality, may see something liberating in putting on the costume that allows them to behave in ways that they normally would not, and probably not considering the bigger picture issues here, you know, as far as what God has specifically prohibited. Children are not likely to take those into account when they're picking out a Halloween costume, and they're going to look for stuff that, is cool or, you know, looks cool, to their friends. And again, with the culture reinforcing this idea that vampires are sparkly, sexy, and cool, like Edward Cullen, or like zombies, you know, gives you an excuse to just kind of shamble around mindlessly and, you know, might want to pick out costumes, those characters as costumes for Halloween. How difficult is it going to be for parents to say, well, I think we need to rethink this a little bit?
Well, challenging, I would say, because, I mean, nobody wants their children to be, you know, left out of fun, per se, but, you know, fortunately, there are lots of other alternatives that don't involve dressing up like a blood-drinking, flesh-eating demon. It's going to be difficult to get away from those images because of the fact that they've embedded themselves so deeply into our sort of social conscience, as a people, as a society. Because we're bombarded with those images nearly constantly, and particularly this time of the year. So yeah, it's going to be a challenge. It's going to be difficult. And I can't make those decisions for people. But again, what I would encourage is that look at these images through the lens of the Bible. And if children are old enough, to handle it, and maybe talk with them a little bit about that. Now you don't want to be graphic or gory about it, but there's no harm in looking at what the world does and comparing it with what the Bible does.
Yeah, something occurred to me, and I wonder what your take is on this. I wonder if our secular society, and Hollywood is as secular and anti-Christian as any place in America, a lot of the vampire entertainment of previous generations, and you see it pretty clearly in the 1930s Dracula with Bela Lugosi, what stops him is the power of Jesus Christ. I mean, you know, it's the cross, but You know, even up to, what was the movie? Fright Night, which was a comic take on the whole idea. Roddy McDowall plays an old...
Roddy McDowall.
Yeah, right. an old star of horror films who's hosting late night movie, horror movies on a television network. Shadow is form itself, but at a kid who's convinced that a next door neighbor is a vampire has moved in next door, calls him out of retirement and has to do battle with it. And there's a scene in which a guy holds up a cross to the vampire, played by Chris Sarandon, and knocks it out of his hand and says, "You fool, that only works if you believe it." So up until, say, recently, there was that aspect of the vampire, of being a type of antichrist, and that it was the power of Christ that ultimately was required to defeat the vampire. Holy water burned him, a stake through the heart, representative, I would propose, of the cross, because it had to be a wooden stake driven through the heart.
Well, and most often in Europe, it had to be a poplar, which, according to tradition, was the wood that was used to make the cross of Jesus.
Okay. But in the modern versions of the vampire story, there is no mention of Christ or the Bible. And how is that going to influence the story of the vampire? I mean, is the vampire being turned into a positive character because of the removal of the one thing that could defeat the vampire, which is Christ?
Well, it's the postmodern vampire. And on celluloid and paper, that doesn't matter. But again, in reality, it's a complete different story. Because again, if we approach these things for what they are, which is demonic, you can't strip away the morality. You can't strip away the nature of evil that is engendered in the character of the vampire.
Yeah.
It's centuries of, if not millennia, of records of these kinds of spirit creatures. Many of those records attesting the fact that they're spiritual in nature to begin with, even if they can manifest corporeally, that there's some sort of malevolent spirit. I mean, you can look in medical treatises that were written by Babylonians and Egyptians, even the Greeks, and they still believe that sicknesses were caused by some sort of malevolent spirit. Even in Jewish tradition, this was a fairly common idea. And so prescriptions for medical treatments were often some sort of herbal concoction, but they also involved a hymn or an incantation, or in the case of the Egyptians or Babylonians or what have you, some sort of spell to ward off an evil spirit. But the prescription in the Bible for demonic oppression is very clear. And we have to use those against creatures that are perceived as these demonic vampiric creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pretty easy to ferret out. It doesn't take Abraham Van Helsing to figure out what they are.
Or Abraham Lincoln, for that matter.
Or Abraham Lincoln, for any Abraham that happens to hunt vampires.
and this is a question that's worth asking, because when you do a search for vampires on Google, the first website that comes up is one devoted to people who believe that they are vampires, telling them how to become one, how to know if you are one, how to find sustenance if you are one. So there is a subculture out there, a subculture of the goth subculture. So it's a subculture that is pursuing this lifestyle because they believe that they really are vampires who have to feed on the life essence of others, whether it's blood or, in the case of some who believe that they feed on the psychic energy of others, called psi vamps. It is a real thing. There are very confused individuals out there. Not all of them are young, who have adopted this lifestyle because they believe that's how they're supposed to live. And, in my view, Judd, again, welcome your take on this. In my view, these people, whether they realize it or not, are being influenced by powers, principalities, and rulers of spiritual darkness.
Oh, I would echo that without question. I think definitely what you're looking at is, at the very least, a demonic influence. And on the other end, some kind of oppression, kind of demonization that these folks are dealing with. It's interesting because it's not natural for a human to crave blood. It's not sustenance for humans. It's never meant to be sustenance for humans.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jed, we've filled up an hour here, and I know that there's plenty more that we could discuss. But in the interest of keeping this to a manageable length, we'll wrap it here. Just any closing thought that you'd like to leave with listeners to the podcast who may have a family member or family member with children or children of their own, in how do we approach as Christians the holiday, and I guess I'm using that word loosely, Halloween, and in particular the idea of celebrating creatures who are standing in clear opposition, whether fictional or those who believe that they are in reality, intended to violate some very basic prohibitions that God laid down all the way back in the book of Genesis.
Well, again, I would just encourage people to take a step back and look at things through the biblical lens. Again, for the vampire, strip away the shiny, sparkly skin, the literary stuff. Strip away from the zombie this almost Dionysian abandon that's embodied in the concept of a zombie. You know, for any of these monsters, quote unquote, I think people should do that and step back. I mean, it's not, even if popular film and literature have embraced these as sort of escapism or fun or what have you, be discerning in what you allow yourself to be exposed to, what you allow your children to be exposed to. That would be my parting word.
Dr. Jed Burton is the author of Interview with the Giant, Ethnohistorical Notes on Nephilim. He's an archaeologist, historian, and has engaged in paranormal research from time to time. His work is online at burtonbeyond.com. Judd, always an education and always a pleasure talking with you.
It's always good talking with you too, Derek.
Judd's website is burtonbeyond.com, and of course there'll be a link in the show notes at vftb.net for that. A couple of news items to pass along as we record this on the evening of October 26th of 2014. Is it conspiratorial or perhaps paranoid to wonder if it's a bad thing that the new Ebola czar appointed by President Obama, Ron Klain, has been recorded in a public interview saying that the biggest problem facing public policy officials is overpopulation, and that Obama's science czar, John Holdren, was co-author of a book with Paul Ehrlich back in the 80s, a gentleman who picked up the whole Malthusian nightmare and ran with it. Thomas Malthus, of course, the 18th century philosopher, maybe that's not the right way to describe him, but anyway, did some simple calculations and discovered that the Earth would run out of food sometime in the 1800s, which, of course, didn't happen. But that didn't stop people like Ehrlich from picking up on that idea in the 1980s and running with it. And there are those out there who are convinced to this day that overpopulation is the gravest problem facing humanity. And two of those gentlemen just happened to be in charge of advising the president on science policy and coordinating the response to the Ebola outbreak in the United States. Perhaps that is just a bit conspiratorial. So we will leave that lay, just bringing those up as data points to consider. But there are some scientists who are worrying that this is mutating and turning into something new, something that they haven't seen before. This past week, last week, Tuesday, in fact, that would be the 21st of October, Dr. Michael Osterholm, who's the director of CIDRAP, which is the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy, based out of the University of Minnesota, said that he had been asked to keep things quiet about the Ebola virus and finally decided to speak out because he just thought it was a good idea to get the information out there. But there apparently has been a change in the strain of the Ebola virus that they are witnessing in this outbreak in West Africa. Now, again, the outbreak in Western Africa is something new for the Ebola virus. Typically, in the past, when it has popped up, it's been in Central or Eastern Africa, Congo, Uganda, places like that. So the outbreak in Western Africa was a bit disturbing. And the virus apparently is proving to be more efficient at infecting lung tissue, which is disturbing because, well, what that means is that as you cough or sneeze and you expel droplets, perhaps droplets of sputum, you are in fact expelling, or you could conceivably be expelling virus. And this is something Sharon's been talking about for quite some time. So, but finally, people in positions of authority who know about these diseases, it is their job to know about these diseases, not speculate, but people who are in a direct position of responsibility when it comes to learning everything that they can about diseases like Ebola are saying, yeah, this is transmissible through the air. Maybe not in an aerosolized form where virus particles are actually floating in the air, but in the same way that you would transmit a cold, that perhaps if you sneeze droplets out, they land on a surface, the virus survives there for several days, it can be transmitted that way, which is not what we've been told by the government all along. And it would really be nice to get some straight, accurate information from the government. Not that I'm an expert on this, I just happen to be married to someone who is intelligent enough and has the education in this field to understand when misinformation or disinformation is being put out there. There's also another top scientist who worries that, and this would be Dr. Peter Jarling, who has, you see, he's a chief scientist at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, where he has been working with emerging viral pathogens, and he is concerned that this particular strain of Ebola is mutating to become more infectious. So we pray that by the time Sharon's book on the topic, Ebola and the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse, is due to be released, which is at the end of November, hopefully by then we will be on the downhill side of this outbreak. Because if not, the number of infected by then will be substantially higher than the 10,000 or so that we've been told. So, again, our prayer that this thing is starting to burn itself out and that cooler heads will prevail. And by cooler, I mean those who are willing to say, if you've been to an area where this virus is known to be running rampant or existent, then perhaps you should remain in quarantine until the incubation period is passed. There was another news item that popped out this week. Actually, it was an interview that related to the research that Sharon and I have been doing about the transhumanism movement. About 20 years ago, a couple of fellows named Richard Hernstein, I'm not sure, and Charles Murray wrote a book called The Bell Curve, Intelligence and Class Structure in American Life. The book got a lot of criticism because they dared to put in print the fact that there are differences between various racial groups on intelligence tests. They took some pains to say that they weren't sure whether this was a result of nature or nurture. In other words, they could not say that there was any definite evidence that that identified genetics or social structures or socioeconomic class as the cause of the differences between the races in the intelligence tests. But of course, when you're dealing with that particular topic in modern America, the facts really don't matter. Many of their conclusions were just dismissed out of hand, and Hernstein and Murray were labeled racists, which is too bad because I think they had some very insightful things to say. I've not read the book, but I should. In the interview, which was prompted by this being the 20th anniversary of the publication of the book, Charles Murray was asked which theses of the book are most relevant to American life right now? And Murray responded in something I thought was very interesting. He said that there were two main theses of the bell curve. First, that changes in the economy over the course of the 20th century made brains much more valuable in the job market. Okay? Which makes sense. We've moved from being an agrarian through an industrial to an information technology, an information based economy. And so a strong pair of arms, a strong back are not as important in the job market today as they were 100 years ago. His second thesis was that from the 1950s onward, from the 1950s onward, colleges had become much more efficient in finding cognitive talent wherever it was and shipping that talent off to the best colleges. We then, quoting Murray, we then documented all the ways in which cognitive ability is associated with important outcomes in life, everything from employment to crime to family structure to parenting styles. Put those all together, we said, and we're looking at some serious problems down the road. Let me give you a passage to quote directly from the close of the book. And now I'm quoting Murray, who is quoting Murray from The Bell Curve. He quotes, "Predicting the course of society is chancy, but certain tendencies seem strong enough to worry about. An increasingly isolated cognitive elite, a merging of the cognitive elite with the affluent, a deteriorating quality of life for people at the bottom end of the cognitive distribution. Unchecked, these trends will lead the U.S. towards something resembling a caste society, with the underclass mired ever more firmly at the bottom and the cognitive elite ever more firmly at the top, restructuring the rules of society so that it becomes harder and harder for them to lose." End quote. What he's saying is that over the last 60 or 70 years, American colleges and universities have picked the brightest minds, sent them to the best schools, and that over three generations, a caste society, a class society based on the most intelligent at the top, the most intelligent, more likely to be high wage earners, and in positions of responsibility where they're able to rig the game so that their children have advantages over those at the bottom end of the cognitive scale. The reason I found this interesting, and because I mentioned this as one of the flaws I see in the transhumanist movement, which they have not yet recognized or refused to acknowledge, is the development of a genetic caste system. If the transhumanist movement really takes hold in the industrialized world, the Western world, when you add that component, the ability not only for a cognitive elite to develop, high wage earners, the most intelligent, highest wage earners, and give them the ability to choose the genetic makeup of their children to guarantee or at least give their children a better chance at being more intelligent, more healthy, better looking for that matter, than their parents a couple of generations further down the line, this caste system is only going to calcify. It's going to be harder and harder for those at the bottom of the ladder to move up that ladder because those at the top will rig the game. And the game is rigged. I mean, all of us with eyes to see and ears to hear just need to look around and see that the game is already rigged in favor of those who have. You know, the old joke about the golden rule, them with the gold rules. It's not entirely impossible for those at the bottom to work their way up. But it is becoming more difficult, and American society and the way we've put an emphasis on cognitive ability, the best brains getting the best opportunities over the last 60 years, has changed the rules of the game. And if we add a genetic component to that through transhumanism, because who's going to be able to afford the technology? Certainly not those at the bottom end of the cognitive scale. It's only going to make things worse. There will be a genetic nobility and a genetic underclass. One of the key issues that I have with the transhumanist movement. Anyway, that story just caught my eye, and I'm going to have to incorporate that into my presentation on the transhumanist movement, and certainly we'll work that into the book as well. Coming up, we've got, well, gosh, I have not pulled out the schedule here, but Russ Dizdar is on the schedule. The interview recorded at Pikes Peak this summer. We will have that interview posted online Wednesday. Now, this week should be an interesting week as far as our schedule goes because we're doing some travel. And I guess I can let this out because Tom Horn let the cat out of the bag in an interview with Gary Stearman here just a few days back. We're going to be traveling down to Tom's, if I could should call it a compound, but anyway, his facility in Crane, Missouri, which is near Branson, where he's built a new television studio, and we'll be recording some interviews for a what will become a pilot for a program called Skywatch TV. Gary Stearman is going to interview Sharon about her forthcoming book on Ebola. That'll be next weekend. So because of the travel and because of the uncertainty of internet access, I'm not sure what our schedule is going to be like next weekend. I didn't work far enough ahead to get an interview set up for next weekend, and I'm not sure I'll have time between now and then to do one. But I'm going to take some equipment with us. Maybe we can get Gary Stearman and Terry James, who will also be there, I understand. Maybe we can get the two of them in a sort of a roundtable discussion of current events and their impact on prophecy. We do hope to have an interview with Dr. Rick Strassman soon about his new book, DMT, The Spirit of Prophecy. This is the follow-up to his book, DMT, The Spirit Molecule. But need to set that up. And again, looking at my schedule this week, I don't know that we'll be able to get her done for next weekend. Then November 5th, which is a Wednesday, another Pikes Peak Prophecy Summit interview. Dr. Thomas Ice, a gentleman well known as a scholar of the pre-tribulation rapture. And that interview recorded at the Prophecy Summit. We actually wound up dealing a lot more with the topic of dominion theology because he has written and researched that particular aberration of Christian doctrine and was publishing on that topic 20 years ago. So he saw this coming 20 years ago, but he is well-respected as a scholar of prophecy, and the discussion that we had out in Colorado was really interesting. Hope you'll enjoy that, but that'll be posted on Wednesday, November 5th. Other interviews coming up in the month of November. Brian Gadawa has the latest installment of the Nephilim Chronicles ready for release, David Ascendant, and we'll talk with him about that. And look to have Alan Kirshner of Eschatos Ministries back. He is one of the leading proponents of the pre-wrath rapture position. And we'd like to investigate that a little further and talk a little bit more about the differences between pre-wrath, pre-trib, and why those differences matter. So, but again, we'll firm those dates up and you'll see them on the schedule at vftb.net. Sunday mornings at 10:30 Central Time, which until we get past the end of daylight savings, which will be next weekend, actually, that's UTC-5 if you're overseas, UTC-6 once we get back into standard time. But of course, all of those programs are uploaded and available in the archives. So if you don't make it live, you can hear them in retrospect. And the discussion we had today on Genesis 10 and 11, really interesting because that involved the Table of Nations. Where did the people groups of today originate? And then Genesis 11, of course, is the Tower of Babel incident. Who was Nimrod? Why did he cast such a long shadow across history? I mean, the 32nd and 33rd degrees of Scottish Rite Freemasonry are symbolized by the double-headed eagle, which is an emblem that traces its roots back to Nimrod. So we only know about this guy from about 9 verses in the Bible, at least in the book of Genesis. There are a couple references later on calling Assyria the land of Nimrod. But why was he so important? What happened at Babel? Where was Babel? Was it actually Babylon or somewhere else? That's all part of the discussion we had this morning on Genesis chapters 10 and 11. When you start digging into the Bible, it's a lot more interesting than, it's a lot more interesting than I ever thought it was when I was a kid growing up in church. So coming up November 8th and 9th, that is the weekend after, a week after we return from Missouri. The 8th and 9th is the Quest for Truth virtual conference. Doug Hamp, Rob Skiba, the guys behind this, and that will run from 6 p.m. Central Time until 11 p.m. Central Time on Saturday the 8th, and then from 8 a.m. until 11 p.m. on Sunday the 9th. Again, that's Central Time. with a lineup of speakers that includes, of course, Doug and Rob, John McTernan, Doc Marquis, Daniel Duvall, Freeman Fly, a really interesting guy I got to meet for the first time virtually just the other night, who has done a lot of work on symbolism, the symbolism of the occult and how it's in a lot of places around us in everyday life that we're not even aware of. You basically log in and watch this on your PC, on your laptop, on your mobile device if you choose. And the presentations will come to you wherever you are. You can watch them live, watch them again in the archive at least for 30 days, probably longer than that. That's still to be firmed up. The cost is $49.95. And there's a special offer that was to have expired this past Friday night, the 24th. It is being extended through next Saturday, November 1st. Register and you'll get over $100 worth of digital resources. I've included a couple of my ebooks, novels. Hopefully you'll find them entertaining. And if you've got a conspiratorial bent, The God Conspiracy should be right up your alley. I managed to pack every internet conspiracy pretty much into The God Conspiracy, but tried to keep it as close to, say, a biblical worldview, at least for the protagonists, some of the main characters. Also then the Iron Dragons, which is sort of a sci-fi fantasy mashup and a fictional world I need to revisit at some point when I have the time to sit down and write. But included those, there's some other resources in there, video, graphs and charts, that timelines that Rob Skiba has developed that are suitable for printing. And you'll get all of that if you register by next Saturday, November 1st. That is at theq4tconference.com. You'll find a link at vftb.net. The following weekend, November 15th, it is the Prophecy Forum Conference, A World Turned Upside Down. And Sharon and I will be participating in that, also in virtual fashion, a roundtable discussion of the transhumanism movement that will be at 3 p.m. Central Time. But that conference goes on all day, well, afternoon and evening on Friday the 14th, and then all day on Saturday the 15th. And we have a link to that in the right-hand column at vftb.net also. We're honored to be a part of that, even if virtually and in spirit only. So look for those. A lot of good content coming out of that one. Chris Putnam just added to the speakers list for the World Turned Upside Down Conference, November 14th and 15th. Now, we remind you that A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme, Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. As always, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.
I don't want to nitpick, Tom, but is this really your plan? Spend your whole life locked inside a mall. Maybe that's okay for now, but someday you'll be out of food and guns, and you'll have to make the call. I'm not surprised to see you haven't thought it through enough. You never had the head for all that bigger picture stuff. But Tom, that's what I do, and I plan on eating. I mean, no one's gonna eat your eyes. All we wanna do is eat your brains. We're at an impasse here. Maybe we should compromise. If you open up the door, we'll all come inside.